All right. Mr. Coram, whenever you guys are ready, we'll get started again. Mm-hmm. Turn on your mics, please.
I pressed the wrong button. Hold her. No, I pressed the wrong button here. Is it on? Madam Chair, what I'm doing is bringing this up because the answers to Senator Nicholas's questions today are, we just had time to get those on a single set of charts, and that's that supplement. So, Madam Chair, Would it be appropriate for me to carry on through with a standard budget presentation and then spend the rest of the time answering questions? Okay. Then what we'll bring up is this presentation. Where we were at this morning, the last thing I mentioned to the group was that your committee was the table on page 9 of your budget book, which had all that inventory stuff on there, is erroneous. It did not take into consideration some other permit approvals, and we have an updated table for that. If you need it, we have it on slides, but I'm not sure that it matters an awful lot now that we're into the discussion about what the budget needs are going to be with the governor's recommendation. But anyway, that chart, I just wanted to point out I had a mistake in it. So where we were at on the on land quality, I think today was the we just finished the slide on the support costs, explaining what those numbers were, along with how the governor was going to handle the FTEs through a B11 process. We were on this chart when Senator Nicholas raised the questions about manpower, which we're prepared to answer when we get through. And so, what we wanted to do now, so. And maybe I'm one step ahead of myself on the chart you see on the wall. But in essence and in summary, the supplemental request for the Land Quality Division has four people being added through a B11 process after the session. It has $1.5 million in it that the governor is reserved for us pending a good high-quality plan for backlog reduction in the Land Quality Division. And then it has in it $100,000 to follow up on a organizational evaluation that we conducted last fall on our own action. And then it has a few more dollars in there for the support costs that will net out with the FTEs. So to summarize, we've talked about the four people a little bit. Those four people. And maybe just to pause for a second and let you know where those four people are going. There are going to be two natural resource scientists. Now, those are folks that can handle general permitting workload, inspecting workload, and things of that sort. And then there is going to be one hydrologist that will be dedicated to the uranium issues, as well as the lease by application issues that are coming at us with the coal mines, and one hydrologist for something we call CHIAs. Now, that's an acronym. CHIA stands for Cumulative Hydrologic Impact Assessment around the mines. Now, this Cumulative Hydrologic Impact Assessment is a very significant regulatory matter. And what is required of us by the law is that we evaluate the cumulative effects to groundwater table around all of the mines. And you can well imagine now in the Powder River Basin, with all of those mines, there is a cumulative effect on the groundwater table. There are rules, and so we have to conduct more and more evaluations that are even more and more complex because they take into account different drawdown rates at different mines. You have to factor in the coal bed methane effects, if any, and it's a growing regulatory burden, but it's a result of the increased production in the mine. So again, to repeat, two generalists that can work on coal permits and gravel permits, uranium permits, trona permits, the whole bit, and then two that are focused on hydrology, essentially. One for the cumulative hydrologic impact assessment, and one for specifically for uranium, and as these upcoming LBAs come in, they'll be doing some work there. The $1.5 million for the contractual assistance to reduce the backlog, obviously we have to do a more detailed plan. We did submit a plan to the governor that was it was done over a couple of week period right at the end of the year, so you know he's going to expect a more detailed plan. So I really don't want to get into the details of the thing we submitted to him, but just give you the highlights. Now, the we are assuming, and I'll go back up to the history bullet on the top of this page, we are assuming that in the 2005 time frame, the backlog was acceptable to the regulated community and seemed to be something within our reach. So those numbers back then were 161 permanent maintenance actions and 41 new applications. In 2010, that backlog had grown to 355 permit maintenance actions, and these are the correct numbers, not numbers off of that chart that I told you about, and 95 new applications. This sort of tells a story about why we have to address the backlog. It tells a story about why we need new people, but it also tells a story about why we have to examine our work processes. And I'm bouncing around on a slide with you, but that's the last bullet on the slide. So what I would like to do next is give you some detail behind this backlog reduction, if you're interested, just to let you know there. So if we look at those, if we just assume, because we had to pick some target, the governor may pick another target for us, and so I want you to make sure you put these numbers in that perspective. But just selecting 2005 and where we were at in 2010, the target is we're going to have to take 259 applications out of our mix this year. Now, Mr. McKenzie has done an excellent job in the latter part of December going through and analyzing that backlog in fair detail. And we believe of the 259 that are in the backlog, 113 of those can be taken care of with some sort of an administrative action on our part. For example, four of those, not very many, but four of those are Department of Energy remediation projects that probably don't belong on a permitting backlog. And they've been there for about 8 or 9 years while they continue to do the remediation. 20 of those items are things that we really ought not to have in the backlog because it's not necessarily applications so much as they are something that we are tracking. Now, I have to tell you that the system that was in place with Land Quality Division, they just used temporary filing numbers, and they always, anything that ever came in, no matter what it was, got a number assigned to it. So what we have to do when we talk about taking down permitting backlog, we want to make sure we clean up this database, and that's what this administrative thing is going to do. 45 of those items are inactive applications where there has been no response from the applicant for over 1 year. 28 applications where there has been no action by DEQ for 1 year. And then lastly, there are 16 actions that are tied up in federal agencies. You know, you may be aware of this, but just briefly, there are between a half a dozen and a dozen federal agencies that we have to either get concurrence from or pass sign-off on permits across the agency. In land quality, the Game and Fish has a strong role, the Office of Surface Mining at the federal level, the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, the list goes on. And there are a bunch of those that have been hanging around in the feds for some time. We're going to be writing letters. And in the case of real people out there with applications, we're going to write them a letter and say, you can, you know, do one of two things. Either agree that this ought to be off the backlog and start all over when you're ready, or let's make a plan on how we're going to get this across the goal line. So we're not going to be heavy-handed about this, but we are aiming to clean up this backlog, and we do need to get with the applicants and have that dialogue, and that's what we intend to do. Okay, it's four DOE remediation projects. 20 need to be just taken off the list because they're not permit applications. They're tracking items. 45 are inactive applications where we have not heard from the applicant in over a year. 28 are in there and have had no response from or no action on the part of the DEQ for over 1 year? No, DEQ. And 16 that are tied up in the federal agencies.
Director Cora, when we finish this, or before markup next week, could you just give us a printed copy
yeah,
for everyone?
We'll do it.
Thank you.
Okay, so, excuse me, that takes care of the administrative actions. Now we have the rest of this chunk of work that we got to go attack. A part of this, part of the concept behind this plan is going to be to go out and hire outside contractors to help us get this job done. Now, we haven't yet determined how we would use the contractors. There are conflict of interest issues, there are availability issues, and there are efficiency issues. It would not do us any good to go hire a contractor that just came in off the street and then we'd spend the next 6 months training them on how to read the rules and do the permits. So this is going to take some effort on our part. And we're going to use those contractors in a variety of ways. Now I have to, in one way is going to be, or maybe, that we can put them right to work on minor permits, just like a regular employee would work on a minor, on a small permit, like sand and gravel. We can put them to work on some non-significant revisions to existing permits, which are relatively small. You know, I mean, they could be large or small, but they basically that's not the same training workload. We can also have them work side by side with an existing employee. And then lastly, and this is, I have to explain this before I say it. We can use them to take the other workload off of the employees we have so that our employees can, those employees can spend 100% of their time doing the permits. We're going to get into this in a little bit more detail later on, but the Land Quality Division throughout its history has been organized differently than any of the other divisions. In all of the other divisions, we have a department that does enforcement compliance inspecting. We have a part in inside a section. We have a section that does just permitting. And we have a section that generally does just monitoring. And maybe even a section that just does reclamation, depending upon where you're at. So in other words, those other divisions are organized along what I would call functional lines. The Land Quality Division was set up years ago to be organized what I would call along a business model, in other words, along the business line. And what that means is all of the employees in the Land Quality Division, unless they're clerical or unless there's a specific job one or two of them would do, each employee in that division does permitting, he does field inspections, he does compliance actions, he handles some reclamation, and in other words, he's what we call a lumper, for lack of a better word. In other words, we have employees who do all of those things. That's been a culture that has evolved with the industry. The industry likes that a little bit because, you know, they always see the same guy inspecting their mines as writing their permit. And so, you know, but maybe now we need to reexamine that. But the net effect of that is that out of all of the employees, out of our total headcount, Land Quality, there's only the equivalent of 23 full-time equivalents doing permitting. So when we go to get contractors, we can use those contractors to do the field inspections, to do the checking on reclamation, and free up the guy that knows how, the guy that's only spending part of half of his time writing permits and make him spend 100% of his time writing permits until we get the backlog worked out. So to just sum up, the use of the contractors is going to turn out to be what it'll be when we get in the middle of this thing and we have a more detailed plan. But we have options for using the contractors, I guess, is a short point for that long-winded thing I just told you about. Now, go ahead. The breakdown, just while, and then I'll pause for a minute. The breakdown on the where the contractors will be working. We have to have work done on 34 new permit applications, 21 new exploration and mine exemption requests, 12 significant revisions, 50 non-significant revisions. Now, I'll just tell you the difference. Oh, yeah, okay, I'm sorry. 5-0 for non-significant. 14 for bonding actions. 6 renewals and transfers. And 5 expiration revisions, revisions to expiration licenses. So that's kind of the where the work is on the backlog, and that's what we're going to attack. And that's part of what the governor's expectation is that we attack that work, that backlog this year. And as he mentioned to you yesterday, he's not going to let us get after that until we give him a pretty good plan. And so we're prepared to do that. So anyway, now there's a third leg to this stool. If we don't really take a hard look at the way we do work in land quality, and all we add is 4 people, we might see the backlog grow again. So there's a piece in here where I think we can attack efficiency. We have our IT project that we're prepared to talk to you about in a little while. We're going to do this follow-up on our organizational assessment. That assessment points out some service standards and some expectations from the regulated community and tells us some of the things we need to be working on inside the division. Better transparency, for example, consistency across the districts, preparing checklists, doing some outreach, things of that sort, which will all help the quality of applications and hopefully will get us focused on a more streamlined process. The other thing is we do Kaizen. He sent me a note. Yeah, Kaizen is the Japanese word for continuous improvement. You have heard me talk about that before. We have used it in pieces of our IT project. What a Kaizen process is we bring in a consultant who knows how to do this stuff. We bring in our permitting staff, and we bring in people. We basically bring in customers or people that are needing the permits. And they do a complete process flow diagram, and they look to eliminate unnecessary steps. If you remember a couple of years ago, I told you one of the successful stories in IT was we were able to take out the number of days to get some of these waivers, which are the oil and gas waivers, out the door. We took it down from like 120 days or so down to something like 70. We've had good luck with Kaizen. It's been well received by the regulated community and others, and we're going to use that to attack our completeness reviews and 2 other things. So that segment of this is all going to be part of this overall plan that we're going to work out with the governor. But the IT project's ongoing. We've got we had to put a 1-year hiatus on it, and we'll explain that here when we get to it. But that's what we're going to do. That's what we intend to do. So that $1.5 million from the governor is kind of fit in here along with the 4 people. And Madam Chair, that's my story. I've got a slide up here that talks about some of the other issues.
Continue with that right now.
Okay. Yeah. In the past year, especially, in the last couple of years, and this happens across the agency, we do more than write permits. We do inspections. We have a growing universe of sites that we need to deal with. We have increasing rules from EPA. I was going to be up there listening in on the Senate joint resolution on the EPA rules, but I can tell you that's an amazing story with the train wreck thing that they're calling it. But that all piles work down this way. And so there's a lot of other things that an employee does across the agency, developing new rules, new standards. But here's some issues with regards to land quality. And, for example, OSM oversight and OSM rulemaking. OSM right now is changing the stream protection rule, and you've all heard about the mountaintop mining removal issues in Appalachia, and they've extended that across the country in terms of redoing. They've teamed up with the EPA. We had to be a cooperator in the EIS that they're doing for that. We're having a hard time keeping up with them, but if we're not there providing some input, we're not really getting a Wyoming perspective into the OSM's rulemaking process. Now, whether they listen to us, that's a whole other question. But we would be remiss in not trying, and that takes people. The other thing we do is we have sage-grouse stipulations. That governor's executive order came out. You're all familiar with it. That was a year's worth of work with probably one and a half full-time equivalents in our business. Because I got to tell you, if you want to put teeth in the governor's executive order and make sure that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't change the definition of status, the major regulatory entity to implement the sage-grouse implementations is the DEQ. We have the federal coalescing pinch points that are coming up. I think the other thing I might say is, you've heard about uranium. I know that. There's increased interest in uranium permitting. That particular issue took quite a bit of time. But we have maybe 20 uranium mines that are going to come into the state. And I've been dealing with coal bed methane for 8 years, and the state's been dealing it for longer than that. And we're still hung up trying to get a permitting system in place that is acceptable to landowners and acceptable to the EPA. It's very, very important when the new industry gets started that it gets started on the right foot, and we did that. There were lots, and we'll talk about that in detail a little later on, but I'd rather get it started off on the right foot and not have coal bed methane too. And then public involvement, this is a big deal. You'll hear about more of this in terms of the air site. But there are more appeals, more citizens demanding that we come out and meet with them. And we like to do that. We're not complaining, but it certainly takes time. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my Land Quality Division story.
Questions from the committee? I know, Director Cora, with the demand that you've had, in particular with CBM, and I know that's part of the permit log, because it's the maintenance of those. Is that correct?
For coal bed methane?
With the permits that are being renewed or maintained.
Oh, for coal bed methane?
And that's...
Yeah, now the... excuse me. We have some data on permitting in the Water Quality Division, although we don't have a backlog number for you there. But
okay.
On coal bed methane specifically, though, that is a good question I'd like to address. Two or three events have occurred. One is the Environmental Quality Council rejected our proposed rules to implement the Agricultural Use Protection Standard for coal bed methane. Sent us back to the drawing board. In the meantime, we were issuing permits, and EPA began to object to those permits. Now, the issue with an EPA objection is that if you don't change your permit, they can either write it or they can just let it sit there and gather dust. They filed objections on two watershed permits, which had a significant number of operators in both of them. Plus, they filed objections on another 100 and... Where'd John go? About another 120 permits. By the way, Madam Chair, I brought an extra reinforcement with me this afternoon, John Wagner, the administrator of the Water Quality Division. So what we've done is put those on hold while we plow through and redo the Ag Use Protection Rule. Now, we had a working group that we put together a little over a year ago. It included 23 people. Excuse my language, but it had all the combatants, as I call it, at the table. We had it facilitated by the University of Wyoming. And we finally got to some common ground. We then assigned that to a technical team, three PhDs. One that the industry picked, one that the environmental groups picked, and one that we picked that was an independent. They went through and did a technical evaluation. We've sent out a strategy, and we just extended the comment period to the 21st of January for all of those folks, the industry people at the table and the environmental group at the table and the landowners at the table, to comment on that strategy. So a lot of that coal bed methane permitting, unless it has anything to do with ag use protection, having to deal with the ag use protection standard, we've sat on. Because if we kick them out under the old rule, EPA will object to them. And I'm pretty sure the industry understands what we're doing. They're able to operate under their old permits. But that's a coal bed methane story. Yeah. Okay.
Separate, but it seems to me that it's similar in the issue that you're having with land quality, in that there's so many new mandates or demands rejections that are occurring. But I'm just curious how it came to this point where all of a sudden it is really a major backlog and you're just facing it
now.
Well,
land quality?
Yeah.
Okay. Which backlog slide do we have, Jim? I got to go.
And was it, John, something that you were reviewing as you were going through the IT renovation of DEQ and how that correlates?
Yeah, I just need to get it. I need to get the page. 16, isn't it?
Well, 14 is where it starts.
Is it in the presentation?
Well, no, it's not back.
Well, no, that's what I think. Madam Chair, if you will, let me just
that's
bring
fine.
This up. This table would be the new table that would be in the budget if
okay.
we were to correct it. But let me just point out that, now remember, in Land Quality Division, I'm only speaking about Land Quality
right.
at the moment. In Land Quality Division, we categorize things in two areas, new permits or new major amendments and things of that sort, or maintenance items. In other words, somebody has a permit and they need to make a change. And if you look in 2005, now that, okay, I'll do that. If you look
okay.
in 2005, the cumulative backlog was 161 in 05, and I'm looking on the maintenance column over here to your left.
Yep.
And it has grown steadily to where it was 355 last month. And that's a manpower. There's a number of issues associated with that. One is manpower. The other is the complexity of some of these actions. And remember, the same people working on maintenance are working on new permit applications. So if I can get you over to that side of the chart next, we had a backlog in 2005 of 41 of the new permit authorizations, and that's doubled to in December to 95. So this has been creeping and growing. Now, I can tell you, and I hope this is taken in this, I'm not complaining. As you've heard me say before, I worked for the governor. I worked for the last governor, and I and every year we're trying to manage and ask for people, as Senator Nicholas is going to get on us about here in a little bit, adding people in all of the programs. And we were only able to add a few people in land quality. We added, we would be making choices. In some cases it was solid and hazardous waste. In other years it was water quality. In other years it was air quality. And I think the mood and by the governor and this legislative body was to give us enough people to get the job done, but not to give us everything we asked for. And so we've been watching this backlog, and we've known that it's been growing, and we've decided that we would tackle this thing with the IT project. And the IT project, and we'll get at that here, and again, I'm probably stealing Todd's thunder a little bit, but the IT project, we put it on hold for a year. Part of it was the sage grouse thing, because the project manager for the IT project was the only person we had available to deal with sage grouse. But the other part of the deal is that we had a contractor, though, that was not good. And we had to terminate that contract and reset the gauges and decide how we were going to go forward. And that contractor, without getting into a lot of issues, the contractor basically was a bad contractor for us. He would underestimate the cost of every little step by two, and he would never meet deadlines. And the work product sometimes didn't match up with what the employees were telling him. So we fired him. And it's taken us a while to figure out how we want to go forward with this. And we're going to go forward using not a single contractor, but we're going to pick our contractors based on their expertise on the given piece of the agency that we're going to work on. So, for example, database and WIPD's permitting, there's a company out there called Windsor that has experience in water quality permitting. So, we'll be more selective about these contractors going forward. But we lost a year there. We did get a lot of good work done up to that point in time, but so that was one of the things, Madam Chair, that we weren't able to get accomplished. And then, But the backlog, and we did a lot of reassignment of people too, and still the backlog grew. One of the things about backlog that's not readily shown in permit authorizations, that's not readily evident. And we don't have a way to tell you about that necessarily, is that some permits are extremely complex and other permits aren't. So for an example, we were at an appeal in the Environmental Quality Council yesterday on a gravel permit that McMurray wants to try to get going in Sublette County. By the way, the council kicked the permit back to us because we didn't consider some things. And then we have Young's Creek Coal Mine, which is a new coal mine. Young's Creek Coal Mine has 3,308 pages and 190 maps and charts and plates. Now, these big permits contain a year's worth of monitoring data for wildlife, for plant life, for vegetation, detailed soil surveys, detailed reclamation plans, detailed mining plans. That's a big deal. So obviously, if we're doing a gravel pit over there that runs 5 days a week mining gravel, that's going to go a lot quicker. If we're doing Young's Creek, it's going to go a little slower. In the case of the uranium one, both us and the industry run a learning curve. Last permits in uranium that were issued by the agency, really, in any bulk, were back in the 90s when there weren't any rules. There was a rule change for uranium in 2005. And quite honestly, we had lost a lot of our experience base over the years for uranium permitting. So did the industry consultants. Plus these new rules, and there was a significant learning curve for both of us in that regard. So it's a mix of the workload, Madam Chair.
I think that helps the committee, too, just to understand that some of the challenges that you've been faced with. And why don't we move forward? And, Mr. Co-Chairman, do you have questions of Director Cora at the moment?
Want to wait? I'm ready for you. Okay. Well, let me move next, if I may, to 30 page. What's that?
Page 7, if you're going to go to AML.
Yeah, just a second.
Will you make sure that we get a copy of that?
Yeah, you should have had a hand. We gave a...
The corrected one?
Oh, the corrected table? I'm sorry. Yes, we will.
Okay.
All right, so now we're going to talk about AML, if I may. And you guys heard, you, Madam Chair, you and your committee heard a lot about AML, so I'm going to try to...
In December, yes, we did.
Yeah, in December. Just as a way of background, there are two funding streams, as you recall. The first funding stream is the $82.7 million that comes to us every year that is the repayment of the prior balance withheld. Those payments end in 2014. Then there is our share of current fee collections based on actual coal produced, and that was ramped up. And you can see on the line that says 2011, there's a $50.1 million amount for that, and we propose to spend that on reclaiming abandoned coal and non-coal mining operations. So it's $50.1 million, and really it's the second half of the biennial request. Last year, when we put the budget in, we only budgeted for 1 year's funding for the AML. Yeah, to come in the second time to get the second year. So a lot of this is continuation and new projects. This is just a brief summary of where we're going to be working. I thought I'd take a few minutes to just tell you about that. We're going to spend $12 million in Hanna and in Carbon County. There are several projects there, some old coal mines. They're going to be fixing some water flows underneath the town of Hanna. Taking care of some drainage issues and water control that problems that resulted from past mining. Rock Springs in Sweetwater, Fremont counties, $9.5 million. A lot of that is underground mine void grouting in Sweetwater area and Rock Springs, and some of the rest of it is up around in up north. Southwestern Wyoming is down around Uinta County and in Lincoln County. There's $1.5 million. One notable project there is a stream. There's an old coal refuge pile that's actually in the Hams Fork River. And so we're going to go clean that. It's been there forever, but it's time to get it out of there. And the Game and Fish is very happy that we're going to be improving the fishery there. Uranium, we have a lot of uranium work going on in the Gas Hills. These are these old abandoned uranium open pits. And then we have some hard rock mines scattered around the state. And then the other on the $4.5 million, we have it takes about 3% of our grants go to administering the grants. So 97% of the money we get for this program gets spent on the ground. But we have coal fires that come up from time to time that we have to put out. And then there's miscellaneous category. But this gives you just a high-level picture, Madam Chair, of what those projects are. The other piece that you're aware of is you get the $83.4 million to spend as the legislature so desires. That's the $82.7 for the, and then there was a carryover of unspent funds of $706,000 previously. This next chart, and Senator Nicholas, Madam Chair, if I may, I hope I heard you correctly when you gave us the instructions on labeling these columns. But the first column, and this is really the summary since 2008 of all of the applications minus 2009.
And this is page 11 of your handout.
This is page 11 of the handout. So that basically sums up in that first column of numbers what's been appropriated and federally encumbered. The next column is contracted and spent. The next column is contracted but not spent yet. And then you see the balances over there on the side. That's a very busy chart. You had it before. I won't dwell on it, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, unless somebody has a question about it.
No? We'll just continue, and they might bring it back up after a while.
Yeah, very good. So. Okay, now the next chart in your package is this roadmap. It's got the red numbers on it, and I'm not going to spend any time on that. It tells the same story as what the prior slide tells, but it gives you a little extra detail of where your money has gone. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation for the supplemental budget.
Thank you, Mr. Cora. So we'll open it up to the committee now for questions. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On the AML, I'm just trying to get my hands around all what we're doing with that and trying to understand that. You know, and I go back to your handout that we had from December about an overview and the intent of AML. And then mm-hmm. It was that my understanding that, did I understand correctly here that the states are getting less money for AML in the future? And part of that was because monies weren't being used for the intent or for what they thought the intent of AML was to be?
Madam Chair, not quite. Let me see, Senator Hastert, if I can get at this in a right way. The history of the abandoned mine land program, and in essence, the law said that the fees charged to coal production, 50% would be kept at the federal level, and 50% would be given to the states. Now, instead, they never gave the full 50% to the states. They gave less than 50% to the states, and that's what led to this prior balance thing. And in 2006, Senator Enzi was a prime mover on a bill that amended the federal statute to where they had to pay us back those prior balance payments. So that's one item. The second item is that along the way, the bill was changed to add funding for orphan miners in the United Mine Workers Union. Now, what I mean by orphan miners is there were an awful lot of coal companies over the time frame, plus steel companies, that went bankrupt and were not able to pay the pensions, nor were they able to pay the medical costs for these old retirees. Now, all of those benefits were a result of negotiation, labor negotiations over the years. And so an amendment was passed that basically got at some of those funds that were those fee collections and sent them to the UMWA for purposes of funding these orphan miners. So so that took away some of the money available. The second another thing that went on is the over the years the trends of production in this country shifted. And whereas back when the first law was enacted, about a third of the production was coming from the West and two-thirds coming from the East, that's flip-flopped, but two-thirds of the problems remain in the East. So they had a significant issue of trying to find a way to divert real cash to those significant mm-hmm. problems in the East. And in the 2006 amendments, they fixed that. They took care of our prior balance payment, and they guaranteed our full share going forward, coming from what we call unappropriated funds in the U.S. Treasury. And so, but in essence, and then along the way, we've been able to use some of those funds for non-coal, because once you become a certified state, and I'll stop there, Senator Hazard. Am I getting close?
Madam Chairman, I guess, and I noticed in your handout, I mean, you talk about the CARE Act. We went under congressional legislation and it passed the House committee, but there's no other action. Oh. And then we have the non-coal, use. And I guess what I'm going to try and get at here is do you have a list of criteria? You know, when we talk about the fact that AML was intended to be used, initial intention for coal reclamation and the abandoned mines and issues around that. What is your criteria? How do I know what your criteria is to know that something fits into that criteria? And then, you know, I see on your chart here how much, you know, we're spending on uranium, you know, and we talk about unappropriated monies being able to use for other projects. You know, when we use quite a bit of it, I see at the University of Wyoming. I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, where the definitions, you know, from the coal come into play here, and then what the guidelines are, and then how we allocate so much more money out on other projects.
Got it.
Director Cora.
Okay, Madam Chair, first of all, let's talk about how we prioritize and identify projects to go reclaim. First thing is we have three priorities. The first priority is an immediate threat to human health and environment. That's a high priority project that we want to do. To protect people from the extreme danger of adverse impacts. Then the next priority is at just taking care of the adverse effects of coal mining on the environment and on human health and safety. And then the third priority is not human health and safety, but just effects on the environment. So it goes immediate threat, think about it this way, immediate threat you go take care of. That's the first priority. The second priority is basically protecting public health, safety, and the environment and welfare from hazards associated with past mines. So that's just a little looser standard, if you will. And then the third priority is pretty much everything else. So that's how we prioritize those. And back in the early 2000s, we did a complete statewide inventory to locate all the coal and non-coal mines we could find so that we could tee up and make plans from that. Now, when the Act was created, it was aimed for coal, but the Act also said that if a state could certify that it completed its coal, it could then go use the money for elsewhere. And in back in 1984 or 86, I can't remember, 84, the state of Wyoming certified and built the School of Geology building, or the geology building at the University of Wyoming. Now, we didn't have all of our coal done, but it worked. But once you certify it, then you can start spending money on non-coal projects. So over the time frame, we've been spending money on non-coal and coal and all of that. Now, I'll pause. Am I helping or hurting?
Madam Chairman, I'm just trying to, you know, I guess understand, is there a, like a written guideline that's, you know, that's if someone were to go out to an area, I mean, obviously I've seen some of the pictures and, you know, some of it looks pretty obvious and it says, you know, okay, but, I mean, is there like a written set of guidelines that says, you know, this is a criteria, or is it open to someone's interpretation? How is this, you know, I mean, if an area, city, or was looking for assistance from AML funding, how do they, where's the guidelines that they can go to find out if their project or issue falls within that?
Say, for example, like Bitter Creek, is that what it was? Or Compact?
Madam Chair, but what I want to do is reel back one step, John, or Senator Hastert, excuse me, apologize. But, Senator, the other thing is on the $82.7 million, that prior balance funding stream, there are no criteria. It's whatever you want to spend it on. And that's spelled out in the Federal Act.
Madam Chairman, and like but when you say one, what we want to spend it on, I mean, who is we? I mean, is that
I'm
what
sorry,
the department decides to spend it on? Or?
No. Madam Chair, the Act, Alan, do you recall the exact language?
Madam Chairman, it's subject to the direction and appropriation by the state legislatures for any projects that they deem. But it has the caveat with an emphasis on energy
dealing
issues.
Yeah, with dealing with the past effects of mining.
So that's a priority within that, but it is subject to legislative appropriation.
Senator Peterson.
I see the wheels turning over there.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Briefly, John, the backlog problem seems to be the driving force here of this supplemental budget request. Trying to address that. In my dealings with some of our bentonite companies up there in our area, most of those companies are adding personnel. And so when I asked them what they were up to and why they were, was there more mining activity, was there more, and all three of them told me that it was because of the permitting process and the required additional hoops that they were being forced to jump through and in the application process. Right. And that got me thinking, you know, as we're asking for this additional workforce for these reviews, the more you ask, the more information you ask for, the more reviewing is going to be causing. So I guess my question in a simplistic way is, are these wounds self-inflicted? Are we at the minimum of EPA requirements as a state, or have we gone above and above and beyond? And what intrigued me about your presentation was this Kazian effort. And hopefully you'll bring in some of these applications or these firms and maybe find out some of these things that we could maybe reduce or make more efficient and reduce that workload for both the companies and the DEQ.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's a good point, and it's a good case in point on what's happened in the last year or so. First of all, let me say that that's all we want to do is write correct permits to meet the standards and rules and regulations. And sometimes those rules and regulations do get changed, and they become more stringent because of a variety of reasons. But the bentonite miners that had trouble with their permits last year had trouble with their permits because we had the sage-grouse implementation criteria. And quite honestly, in order to manage the sage-grouse, we had to hold up on their permit. There was one in particular that we had to just stop and say, look, we have an executive order here. We have an endangered species candidate, and we've got to get some terms and conditions in the permit to deal with that. And that did hold up bentonite permit. That was the only thing, to our knowledge, that was really the curveball thrown at the bentonite miners in the last year or so. There may be something else. I'd be glad to hear about it later, but at least as far as mining, yeah.
Madam Chairman, just to follow up, you know, that's just one of the companies. There's two others on the north end of our county that and maybe they have the same problem with sage grouse. I'm not sure, but
they do.
Okay.
They do. They all have the same similar problem.
Did you have further questions, Senator Hastert?
I might as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I guess enough beating around the bush. Let's tell me exactly then if, just from my understanding, and I've never had a complete understanding of this, let's talk about Rock Springs and dynamic compaction and those homes that sit over the mines. Why is that not, if maybe we can take dynamic compaction off to the side for just a minute and just ask the fact that there's homes that are experiencing subsidence issues because of mine-related issues, why are these not AML type of or fit under the criteria for AML type of funding?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, there are the... There's a two-part question in there, Senator Hastert. The first part deals with ongoing grouting and dealing with the issues of subsidence in Rock Springs in general. And we continue to plow about $9 million a year into that area doing work on trying to do subsidence mitigation. And we have been putting money in Rock Springs to do subsidence mitigation off and on for 25 years. And so it's an ongoing process. There are multiple coal seams under those homes. We have tried to tackle the shallow seams first, but there are deeper seams now that are starting to manifest subsidence to surface, and that's interfering, and we're having to go back in, quite frankly, and regrout some areas. Some of the grouting technology that was used 25 years ago isn't as good as it is today, and I don't think it was as effective. So we continue to remain committed to Rock Springs, and we continue on subsidence grouting and taking care of some of the old mine portals. Now, you mentioned the dynamic compaction project, and let me just speak briefly about that. When the dynamic compaction project started, we stopped it. You're all familiar with a lot of the stories there. There were 17 or 18 residents that said their homes were damaged. In order of how we did this, I told the group if we could figure out what we broke, we would fix it. Now, as it turns out, that's easier for somebody like me to say that wasn't totally familiar with the Governmental Claims Act, and it's a little And so we made some offers. We sent an engineer in, and we tried to, and the standard of determination, when you do this stuff, and then I had to start to fall under the Governmental Claims Act and case law, and the standard of determination is when you see damage, it either was not caused by dynamic compaction, or it was absolutely caused by dynamic compaction, or to a reasonable degree of engineering probability, it was caused by dynamic compaction. So the offers that we made that were sort of my good faith thing went away. The residents were not happy about that. And so we hired a structural engineer to help with those estimates. They didn't like that. And so that structural engineer came up with a way in which we could determine what damage existed before we got there and maybe what we had done there. The residents then came to you and said, we want you to deal with this and hire an engineer that we would like you to hire. And we did what you told us to do last session. You allocated $120,000, and we went out and contracted an engineer out of Colorado who was one of the engineers that was names that were given to us by the legal representatives of those residents. Some of the residents have accepted settlements, and some, and a lot haven't, as you know. That engineering report came in, and that engineering report says that with the damage surveys that they did in the claimant's house, he could not find any damage that he could attribute to dynamic compaction with any degree of engineering probability. So then now along the way, the case was taken over by the Attorney General, which I'm thankful for. There is a pending lawsuit. I'm not able to talk much more about this, Madam Chair and Senator Hastert. But the last engineering report came out and said it made a no call. And the original offers, as I understand them, were withdrawn.
Well, Madam Chairman, and this is just, I guess, and I could talk about this all day, but it just certainly is, you know, this is where the issue of interpretation by individuals can come into play here. I mean, we have an area of these areas of Rock Springs are certainly inundated with mine shafts or mined out areas under these residents' homes, and the feeling in Rock Springs is that and not just the Tree Streets, but in, you know, for the community overall, that, you know, we're not dedicating AML funding in this area where, and you know, and we're putting quite a bit of it to non coal mine or non-reclamation type of issues.
Well, time out. Senator Nicholas, let me get in here because I need to help you. You got to remember as we come here that we have about three roles that we serve on this committee. One is we're still advocates for our constituents. Two is we represent a committee representing the entire body. And finally, we represent the interests of the state to make sure we have a solvency state. So part of what we do on the JAC is we understand that if we went out and paid all claims, if we could, for example, tomorrow say we're going to pay every time anybody drives by a snowplow and gets a cracked windshield. If we want to have another $250,000 or $2 or $3 million worth of expenses, we can do that. When we shift into that mode, it's different. So the if we want to get into, example, for debates, we could debate why do residents build over mine shafts, why don't they plan to avoid that, and there's discussions. Having said that, so what I want to do is make sure we teach ourselves how to ask questions of the agencies in a way that gets you the information and actually expresses the information for us, because the dynamic compaction is an important issue. There are liability issues. It would never be appropriate for a business or a government just to say we'll pay for all claims that people make. So the way to do this line of question is you start off on the right step, and you can continue to do that. And the way you would do that is say, what were the considerations that the agency took place? What did you do with respect to you making evaluations that you made? What is the process of the claims? Where are the claims? And have you considered these things? Are you aware of these things to make sure that the agency is at least aware of the concerns that you have, and get the committee sort of engaged in understanding the issues that you have at a level that you understand? When you get to the advocacy of should more AML funds be earmarked for Rock Springs, that's our debate, and that's what we get to do in the markup. You've got all of us to argue towards that that the monies are going to the wrong place. They ought to go to Rock Springs. They ought to go to homeowners. They should go there, and that's a debate we get for policy, but not for debating with these folks, because that's a policy we get to make. So, John, what I don't want to do is cut you off. I want you to continue your line of questions. Just make sure that you're asking the what, where, is, whys, what have you considered, what do we need to look at. Now, there's also the potential that if we want to ask the Attorney General to come here, we can have an executive session. We could find out what he's doing in litigation. But if we do that, then you have to recognize that when you go into executive session, you're not free to talk about any of that with your constituents. You shift gears. You're in an entirely different mode. But you're free to do that. If you ask the chairs to bring an executive session with the Attorney General in, we'll do that. But once you do that, just like a lawyer, I don't talk about my clients. I don't identify things. You shift to that gear. And if you're ready and you want to do that, we will do that. But that's the line, and all I'm going to do, you continue to ask your questions, and I'm just going to regulate the line is all.
I think Director Cora was going to respond.
You were doing a good job, but I guess, you know, what we need to know as a committee is, what took place. What happened? What did you stop doing? What are the issues? You talked about the employees the analysis. You talked about that. Is there more information that committee members or you, Senator Hastert, would like to have as background information so that we know it as we go into markup?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that. And that's exactly kind of what, just trying to get a clear understanding of where the agency or how the agency came to the determinations that they did, and is there like a set of guidelines from the agency that maybe that they could provide that would help understand?
Think what they've told you is this. Maybe with respect to the $30 million that's allocated for reclamation, and the bottom line reclamation, they've earmarked about $9 million per year of ongoing reclamation for Rock Springs in the area. With respect to the dynamic compaction problem, the problem did take place. There was an issue. It's now elevated to a litigation status. With respect to what in this instance, it's probably not even AML. It could be AML fund that's addressing any injuries, but it could be also coming out of the litigation funds that we set aside for injuries. I don't even know when you do have a settlement with respect to homeowners over dynamic compaction, do the settlement dollars come out of AML dollars that we set aside, or are they coming out of the risk assurance dollars that we set aside in the A&I?
Director Cora?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the settlement dollars came out of the abandoned mine land set-aside account.
You have funds available to settle when those settlements occur.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. Go ahead and I'll help you get the questions out because
I appreciate your indulgence, Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman. And I guess, and just what's the status or the ongoing, what's the status of the ongoing work for Rock Springs, Sweetwater County, as far as AML concerns, as far as the department's concerned.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'll allow the administrator of the Abandoned Mine Lands Division, Alan Edwards.
Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Rock Springs, as you indicated, has got a lot of issues and a lot of challenges associated with it. There's a lot of multiple depths and seams. There's some areas along the edge of Rock Springs that are even underlain by four historical mining zones. So it's very, very difficult to get the best handle on where to approach this first. We look at this in a lot of respects as being partners with Rock Springs and trying to resolve that. But in order to do that, we've also found that we have to be very careful in the projects we pick and how we go about them so we don't create, not to resurrect other nuances, but problems that instead of creating a solution, we're creating a problem. And a classic example may be with grouting. So we're doing continuous field investigations and monitoring to define and identify the next projects that make the most sense to do. We have just completed some geotechnical monitoring investigations in the Tree Streets area for the purposes of defining how complete the past and historic grouting activities were. And then we'll use that to inform a later, an ongoing decision process should we look at grouting there. Even grouting has its own challenges. We have to be very careful in doing some of the grouting because in the wrong circumstances, you can actually, you have the potential of inducing subsidence or causing uplifting if you got too much pressure. So we are very carefully trying to identify those projects that will achieve an effective remediation of a problem. But there's a lot of them there, and they in our view, we've been trying to do the background studies necessary to define and identify which of those make the most sense.
Madam Chairman, is there a way to go ahead. Just if I get questioned quite a bit about some of the projects that are going on, some of the things, when people see the grouting or other issues, or when they see, like part of a street fall in, is there a resource for me through your agency that I can find out, when someone asks me what this truck is doing there and what type of remediations or issues there are?
Mr. Edwards?
Madam Chairman, obviously, when I give out my card to people, it includes my cell phone number, so there is that. But for the purposes of Rock Springs, we do have an individual there, Janelle Hunter, who is actually a part-time employee of ours in Rock Springs. The reason that position was created was in the recognition that there were a lot of issues within Rock Springs. It gives a local point of contact to call and get that information immediately into the process. So it's twofold. One is AML in general, but also is the resource that we have put in place in Rock Springs.
Let me just jump in here, Madam Chairman. With respect to these issues, when members move on to the Appropriations Committee, it is expected by their constituents and others that they'll have a higher level of understanding with respect to what your plans are. So, Alan, the Senator Hastert is now on the Appropriations Committee, and what we would expect from the committee is that you would initiate more contact with him, and when you're in that area, you need to contact him if he's available. Your folks need to get a hold of him, and they need to let him know what you're doing, why you're doing it, how you're doing it. But I guess with respect to the rest of us committee, why don't you tell us a little bit? I mean, you have a resource level that you've earmarked and dedicated for Rock Springs. How did you go about setting that resource level, and is it something that is the level determined by what you think you can reasonably do, or is it set because that's the allocated amount that you decided to apply to the problem?
Sure, and then you can add to it. Madam Chairman, if I may, the current level that we've got in Rock Springs for this year was actually based on the estimates for some very specific projects that we've identified that are far enough along that we can put in place in the field. So there's no preset Rock Springs, Sweetwater County would get $9 million a year. We look to identify the projects we could do and then roll that into our budget development and preparation.
What I would like you to do is to before the session out is sit down with Senator Hastert, go over what your past 3 or 4 years have been with respect to subsidence work in Rock Springs, what you're forecasting for the next 2 or 3 months. And with respect to the rest of the members, the same is true. Every member brings unique problems, and we expect the expertise to not stop, yet rather what we expect is the agencies will give you special response to make sure you bring that level of inquiry. However, you have to remember that once we sit here, we're advocates for the notwithstanding that you have community interests, you have personal ideas. You just have to remember that you're now an advocate for everybody. And the assumption is that when you begin to make specific requests from JAC, agencies should know you're JAC, and they should know that they need to make sure they give you good, complete information. At the same time, you just have to make sure that we're talking about legislative agendas as opposed to personal agendas. And sometimes you have to say, look, I'm looking for this from my own interest, not in my capacity as JAC. But this committee, to work right, needs to get all the information that is available for every member when they make an inquiry. So, Senator Hastert, my expectation from you, on your behalf, is that if you make an inquiry, you get complete information and that you get quick response, so that on behalf of the committee, and then if you see something's a problem, then you bring it to the community. But also my expectation is that when you go home and you're called upon to explain what DEQ is doing, you defend, to the extent that you can, you kind of defend what happened, explain what happened. Particularly if it's if we debate it in the JAC and it comes out and may or may not be what you agree to. But I understand you're going to be called upon to give better explanations because you're on JAC, and you need to help them get there.
Mr. Chairman, in a roundabout way, that's exactly what I was trying to do, because there has been a huge gap in the amount of information that has been provided and has been a source of frustration, so I sincerely appreciate that.
Well, the information flow will, if there was a gap, that stops. You need to get everything. But having said that, and my expectation is if you meet with the Attorney General to talk about litigation strategy, if you're there in your capacity of JAC, you should get information too. But the Attorney General, he'll have to caution you what is confidential and what you can disclose and what you need to adhere to, and that's with respect to all of us. To the extent that we get information, whether it's from facilities, ANI, AG, part of our role is to get executive information. But to have that trust, you have to hold the trust, and holding the trust means that you're going to learn information that doesn't belong in the public. And everybody has to learn to zip their lip on things that are executive-level information.
Director Cora.
Madam Chair, if I may, and I apologize if this sounds a bit like an echo here, but I have to tell you that as far as Rock Springs is concerned, there has been a suit filed under the Governmental Claims Act, and so there's an awful lot of attorney-client privilege information that we're not going to share with you. Unless the Attorney General decides to do so, which should be his call.
What I want to clarify, because I'm not sure if that came out the way it should, but
okay.
We are the executive, we are the branch of the committee that if we want to find out how much is put in the accounts, what's set aside for those accounts for settlement, that's our information. Having said that, they've received information from the attorneys, and they're bound by confidentiality. That's not the source. If we want to go into the source, we receive it from the attorneys, and we get appropriate admonitions and that sort of thing. And we have a sign out there that says executive session, and we can bring executive session in. Ordinarily, I wouldn't encourage you to do that because it's hard to distinguish between information, and it probably doesn't help you serve your constituents. But if it helps you make decisions with respect to your service in this committee, we'll bring the AG up, and we'll all be sworn to secrecy, and it'll be an executive session, and we can do that. But it is true that I would, these folks at this point are the clients, and I would not, and if a client divulges the information in a non-executive session, then you lose the waiver or lose that privilege, and we're not going to do that. But there is a way to get that information if it's, you think it's important.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I, again, just to assure Senator Hastert, we will be out and we will visit with the Sweetwater County delegation. We have done that in the past on a non-routine basis. We will do that again. Well, that's our commitment to you. Secondly, or lastly, on the subject, the Attorney General did write a couple of memorandums to kind of summarize the events around that were mailed to the legislators a year or two ago. And, Madam Chair, I will get copies of those memorandums for Senator Hastert. Well, and for that,
well, anybody, you know, Director Carr, we have five new members on JSC.
That, let
so
me do that for everybody.
I
will get those summaries for the whole committee.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Director Cora. And Representative Esquivel now has a question. Oh, and then Senator Meyer. So we'll start the round.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Director Cora. Just for my historical perspective, the funding forecast only went back to 2008. Was that the first year we got AML funding?
Director Cora.
Madam Chair, you mean that table that I had up there that showed the two funding streams? Yes, Madam Chair. The the Surface Mining Control and the SMACRA Act, if you will, the federal act, has been in place for a long, long time. But this is a report as of the amendments to that federal act that occurred in 2006. We started getting payments for fiscal year 2008, and we usually get those in December. So, yeah, we only show 2008. In the presentation we gave earlier, we had more historical, but we just picked that date because that's when the prior balance payments start.
A follow-up, Madam Chairman?
Go ahead.
What year was the dynamic compaction? When was that going on?
That was 2007, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, that wasn't paid for by AML funding.
Oh, no, Madam Chair, it was. Let me go back and explain. We have been receiving funding from the Abandoned Mine Lands Program ever since it was started in 1979. So we have had an ongoing reclamation project for 30 years, Madam Chair. And so this particular chart was only aimed at because the amendments to the federal act that provide us with those funds changed in 2008. We have always just communicated about funds coming into the program from that date forward because that's the only, you know, the funds that came into the program we spent in the years gone by, and that's a lot of history that we've.
Madam Chairman, just two small quick questions. And then, Director Corey, you had said that there were 17 houses that had made claims?
Yes, Madam Chair, 17.
And how many of those claims were paid or settled?
Well, we have how many remaining? 12? Madam Chair, we have 12 claims remaining.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Thank you. Okay. Senator Meyer. You're up.
I'm going to switch gears away from Rock Springs. And Director Cora, we talked briefly the last time you were here about what we might be able to do in a proactive way to help facilitate. No, this is for Laramie County. To help facilitate in Converse County, to help facilitate either a nitrogen fertilizer plant or expansion of the refinery here in Cheyenne or another refinery. And you mentioned earlier that you had a huge permit that with a coal company, and they had over a year's worth of, I believe it was water quality and air quality measurements and things like that. And I'm just wondering that are those the type of things that we might be able to do, monitor the air, monitor the water in preparation for a site location on a new refinery or expansion, or what things could the state do to be proactive so if those things were to come to pass that we would be out in front of it and be able to help move things along a little faster.
Director Cora.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think the best way to do that would be to offer up and contact those businesses that have those plans, understand what their plans are, and then if you want to help them pay for background studies and things of that sort, that could be appropriated to us to do. We don't do that work. Basically, our job is when someone wants to construct something in the state, they come and talk to us about it, and we encourage them to come talk to us ahead of time, you know, so we can get some of the we make sure that the permit applications start off on the right foot. But then they go out and gather all of the background data and put all of that into a permit. So that does take some time, Senator Meyer, and I really don't know how to get ahead of that curve without a refinery or somebody else coming to us early on so that they can find out what they have to get in the way of data.
So I understand that you know what data they need.
Madam Chair, we know what data they need, and we can tell them that.
Okay. Madam Chairman, I'm wondering if could you give a ballpark figure as far as a budget or what that would be if it was necessary to monitor the air quality around Cheyenne for a year for someone to put a refinery in, or whatever time period that might be, what that might entail as far as an appropriation. I know we've got a lot of air monitoring over in the Pinedale area and continuous monitors like that. I'm just kind of curious if we were going to do some of those things ourselves, what it would cost.
Yeah. Madam Chair, now and Senator Meyer, now that I understand your question a little bit more clearly, we have an active monitoring system around the state, so all of that background data is being gathered as we speak almost. Now, in the Cheyenne area specifically, we just started a brand-new monitor up in North Cheyenne. So that'll give us another data point that we can plug into the modeling effort that we'll need to do whenever, like, say, the refinery in Cheyenne comes in for a new permit application on the air side. We will have better background information for them to use. So we do have a statewide monitoring network. We also require the facilities to monitor the air as well. So they'll have air monitors at their property boundaries. They'll have air monitors upwind. And that data all gets recorded and saved as well. So there's a fair amount of air data out there. On the water side, we have a pretty good idea of the quality of the waters around the state through a very active stream protection system and monitoring system. So a lot of that data exists already.
Representative Edmonds, do you have a question?
I'm switching gears, so I hope Senator Meyer's finished. Okay. Director Cora, perhaps just to help me better understand your department, I'm getting back to the FTEs. Do you and the Department of Environmental Quality move people around into different departments? Do you, I'm not talking necessarily reclassification, but do you shift people's job duties in the Department of Environmental Quality?
Director Cora.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we do. I would like to do more than actually happens, so but people, when we have openings, we post those jobs and people will bid on those jobs from different divisions, so that goes on from time to time. I might add that in the land quality division, and where's that chart? Just rather than find it here, Don.
Don's right behind you. Yeah.
If I can pause just for a second, Madam Chair.
The list that shows the changes to staff and land quality, the reassignments. Do we have that handy?
Okay. The round numbers, if I may be allowed. In land quality, for example, we have only hired 4 people in the last 8 years in the land quality division. And we were going to get into that. One of those is a records clerk. I mentioned that earlier, actually, a little bit about where we had put some of those people. But in addition to handle the changing nature of the permitting workload, we had two vacancies in Cheyenne that we reclassified and put them out into the field offices to handle permitting. So that was one effort we did to handle the workload in land quality that did not require a request for an appropriation. We also reassigned 2 other jobs. One was a open secretary's job that we did not fill, and then we reclassified that to another permit specialist or an environmental scientist job here in Cheyenne. So I think we've made four of those.
Actually, three.
Okay, three reassignments. So occasionally we'll take open positions and reclassify them to manage our workload, and that was just an example of that.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So are you following workflow to the level that when a workflow perhaps goes down in an area, you mm-hmm. take those people back out of? Are you
right.
shifting back and forth?
Director Cora.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we do some of that as well, and we manage that sort of a workload shift a couple of different ways. In some ways, we have a increasing inspection compliance workload because there are more and more facilities that come up in the state every year. And so sometimes we'll shift over there to fulfill our inspecting and compliance needs. All of our federal acts require us to maintain a certain level of oversight and inspections. And so sometimes we slip behind on that, and so I'll use excess people for that on occasion. The other thing is we'll manage by just not filling vacancies. And one chart I might just bring up, for example, and this chart happens to be the vacancy history for the division. Senator Nicholas early a while ago said, you know, there's normally always a certain amount of turnover in the state, and you're always running around with some vacancies. This chart that's on the screen behind me, you can see we've been running around 10 positions over the past 8 or 9 months, actually for the last year. And some of that is just turnover. We can't fill the job. But some of it will go slow on filling the job.
Yeah. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Real quickly, John, the backlogs again, the 28 that were inactive and not acted on by DEQ, you had 45 for that were inactive from the applicant, as I understood it, and then
right.
28 of those
yeah.
DEQ just took no action on. And how? Right. What's the average age of those applications? Are they over a year or two or three? Or,
Madam Chair, I don't think we have an answer to that question right now. We can get it to you.
That number, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator, those numbers represent applications that are at least a year, over a year. And some of those can range from 12 months to 15 months or even a little longer. But most of those are right around a year's worth of time.
You know, I might show this chart. Hmm? You want to show it?
Sure.
Okay.
While they're thinking about that, Madam Chairman, my concern is in cleaning those up. I don't know what the procedure is going to be. Just trash them, what that might cause is the applicant to have to reapply and a lot of frustration. And so I don't know what the term cleanup is going to entail.
Okay. Director Cora.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, we're not going to throw them out without talking to the applicant first and finding out what the deal is with them.
Okay.
With respect to, I mean, if you feel like you're in pressure by the state government or JAC or the minerals to clear applications off your docket simply to show that they're not active, I'd encourage you not to do that. I mean, we won't judge you by applications that industry has placed, and they may have pulled off because for economic reasons they're going to slow down. And they don't want to have to go back and start the application process again. So don't feel pressured to do that. I think I would like to see go back 8 years, show us where your additional employment has been for authorized positions and what the purpose was,
yep.
just so we can see it, because oftentimes my memory isn't as good as it should be.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
With respect to land quality, I think you're doing an efficiency study. Where is that?
Madam Chair, the efficiency study, where it is at right now is we're waiting for a report from the consultant that we'd hired. The preliminary results of that indicate that we need to have better clarity. We need to have better consistency. We need to be doing some checklists and guidance documents for the permit applicants. We need to do some outreach, but we really have to work on this guidance checklist piece and also on consistency from district to district. There are different employees in different districts that may have different standards of review, and that's been brought to our attention, and we have to fix that. There also is, quite honestly, that's come out of this review, some comments around, you know, the way in which we do work, where we have an individual who does permitting and he does inspections and he does everything else, that may not be as good as perhaps having some specialists in some areas that are very good at their field, have a very defined skill set, and can tackle pieces of these permits and get them out more efficiently. So this study has told us that we need to go back and examine that and take a look at how we put together a proper mix of generalists and specialists to attack these permits. I think that's an excellent finding from that group. And quite honestly, the Land Quality Division was put together this way back in 1976. And it hasn't changed. And now is a good time to take a look at that. And I think the employees might welcome that change as well. I mean, they've been fully on board with the assessment. We've kept them informed all the way. But more work is yet to come, Madam Chair. And pardon me? Madam Chair, it's too early for me to predict that in terms of that work.
I don't remember one. Did we put a date by which we would get a report on that, or did we just require a process?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess, Senator Nicholas, what I would ask you to do is wait until we get through with and clear the hurdle with the governor. You know, as the governor mentioned to you yesterday, he's not going to release any of these funds until he's satisfied we have a good plan that does include milestones and communication dates and things of that sort. If I can defer that question until I cross those other bridges with the governor, and then I think that plan will have in it the things you're looking for in terms of updates.
Well, just remember that we've got a committee out there waiting for a report. I spoke with the chairman of the Minerals Committee, and he knows it's there and knows he hasn't seen a report.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got some people
waiting
for that.
Yeah.
With respect to shifting air quality, we have to go back on the floor here, and we're not going to answer all this. But what I would say this is anecdotally from listening to folks that I represent when I'm with my other hat and people that they talk to and when I'm at meetings, there was a time, and I would say up to about 6 or 7 years ago, I could, for the most part, you could warrant that if you made an application for an air permit, that it'd probably be processed faster than any other state that they have sister plants in or other experience in. And I'm finding that's no longer the case. I'm hearing repeatedly anecdotal information where sister plants are getting routine air permits for both significant and non-significant that are taking much, much longer in Wyoming than they do in other states. When I spoke to Senator Beepout this morning, he says he's receiving similar types of information. Another thing that we're seeing is that industry taking permit applications to air quality, that the staff using the entire review time and then right at the end providing a staff analysis, that industry says it looked like they didn't even read the report. They ended up coming back down and meeting with staff staff and saying, look, everything that's in your staff analysis was in a report. My concern is the notion that if your staff are too busy or they're tasked with other things, they get to the end of the review period, they jump in and they create reviews just to shift the obligation back to the industry so that they've gotten their comments and they know they're going back. But it is a concern when we begin to hear that the air quality process is taking much longer than sister plants for exactly the same things. And it's all relate are the things that I'm hearing that from folks that are showing up at Cheyenne, my own folks to Senator B about, but it looks to me like that's an area that we better take a look at when you have those kind of complaints.
Director Cora.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we'll certainly take a close look at the air quality program, but I do have to say that the better an application is when it gets in the door, the quicker it goes. I wouldn't doubt that there are times when the staff is harried with multiple priorities and that they get these letters out late instead of early in the completeness review process. But I think there's also new rules. There's new SO2 standards, new NO2 standards. There's in some areas we're dealing with ozone. It took us quite a while in the permitting areas, especially in southwestern Wyoming, to work up an offset policy so that these permits could actually be issued. We're in a non-attainment area over there. So half the permits are oil and gas permits where they can get up and running without a permit. So I know that there are some. I know that there's one specifically in Albany County and other, well, not there, but I mean other places. We've had permits that get appealed. And so it's a mixed bag. And I would encourage the industry to come talk to me and Mr. Dietrich, and we will focus in on those specific issues where people have problems. But we will take a look at the air quality side.
One of the things that I get concerned, if you have the same staff people that have the opportunity or need to go to the field for whatever purpose, and they're also doing your permit work and they're doing work, it's always easy to take telephone calls. It's always easy to go out and do your field work and leave your desk work. And one of the things I wonder is that we're getting you're getting your work balanced in a way that not enough desk work is getting done and too much non-desk work.
Director Cora.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's a great question. That's a situation in land quality that could be there, Senator Nicholas. I mean, that's in the land quality side. That's where we have the same individuals doing different functions. But on the air quality side, for the most part, permit writers are permit writers. There's very limited field work there. There is some for the modelers and whatnot, but for not as much in air as in land.
Senator Meyer, you get the last say.
Senator Chairman, I'm just wondering about the actual format of your application. Is it simple where it's just like a checklist? If there's certain things that people have to meet to qualify for it, can you develop questions that says, are your SO2 standards lower than this? Check yes. I mean, is there an easy way to do it? Is it all narrative?
No, it's not. Madam Chair, these permits have a fair amount of scientific analysis associated with them. For example, when a person for an air permit comes into our agency, he has to tell us what kind of process he's using. He has to estimate his emissions of the various pollutants. And he has to work with us to define what we call best available control technology. And that is a 4 or 5-step top-down process that we have to work out. And then he has to commit to put that control technology on his facility. So there's detailed atmospheric chemistry involved in some cases for some of these pollutants. In other cases, it's a straightforward mixing model that you use. You figure out how much SO2 is already in the air. You know what the regulatory increment is. You check to see what they're putting in the air. If they've got the control technology on and so on, the beat goes. There are checklists that where you can say, you can check off the box that said you did your model, but the actual modeling itself is a highly technical exercise. And these permits in air are all to varying degrees like that. In fact, large permits, we have to measure the impact and model the impacts. Madam Chair, I'll just say this for the rest of the group. For large sources, for example, when we permitted the Dry Fork power plant north of Gillette, we had to model the impacts of SO2 on the Indian reservation in Montana, north of Sheridan and south of Billings. We also had to measure the impacts to visibility to Badlands and Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota. So the Clean Air Act is pretty specific about all of the analyses you have to do to understand the air impacts of a proposed project. And on major sources, you go out 300 miles.
It's complicated.
It's complicated.
Okay. I want to thank you for your time, Director Cora and team, for all the questions today. And I think you took notes on things that we need for markup, and I appreciate it.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Now, committee, spend a minute here. Okay.
I just wanted to ask Director Cora a quick personal question about the Endangered Species Act. How do we get the Democrats on that list?
Oh, how do you, I know. Yeah, that's good.
Madam Chair, I'll pass along that question to Bob Budd. He's the guy running.
Jesus.